Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part 3 of episode 40, where we're bringing you the panels from our first ever event, the Symposium on Continuities, Disruptions and Management in the Gig Economy that we held on 15th of December 2017 at the University of Sussex. First part of this special episode featured keynote by Natalia Levina. Second part featured our first panel, which included Arianna Tassinari, Sarah O'Connor, and again Natalia Levina. And this is the final panel that we're bringing you in this episode. This one's more focused on methodological issues in studying the gig economy, and it features Gretia Corporal, Marijke Molman, and Rebecca Prentice. If you'd like to find out more about the event, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com, and you will find all the information as well as some bonus features from the episode page. Now, before we get to the episode, we'd like to include an announcement about a similar but larger event that is going to take place in October 2018 in Amsterdam. This one's organized by one of the delegates who were at the symposium, Ivana Karanovic, who is a PhD candidate at VU Amsterdam.
My name is Ivana, and I'm coming to you from Vrije Universiteit in Amsterdam. And I'm here to invite all of you listeners to the Reshaping Work in the Platform Economy Conference, which is taking place on the 25th and 26th October here in Amsterdam. This is the second time that we are organizing this conference due to really successful event last year. The purpose of the Reshaping Work Conference is basically to provide a platform for discussion. We bring together all the various people from academics, the company leaders, government representatives, labor unions, and platform workers as well to jointly discuss the future of work in the platform economy. Therefore, the overall purpose of this conference is to give everyone an opportunity to express their views, because only like that can we arrive at solutions and move forward in a way that benefits everyone. When it comes to the content of conference, it varies from getting the latest research insights from multiple disciplines, so the conference is interdisciplinary, to a bunch of creative sessions where we engage in brainstorming about solutions to the most pressing issues that we are facing in the platform economy. And the format of the conference is very engaging. Last year, for instance, we had a session, Meet the Gig Worker, where we had a number of workers from platforms such as Uber, Helpli, and Deliveroo come on stage and ask questions to representatives of the companies they work for. If you'd like to get more information about the conference, please visit reshapingwork.net. I'm looking forward to seeing you in October.
All right, and now without further ado, please enjoy panel number 2 from the Talking About Organizations Symposium.
So, to give you some context, I want to introduce you to my team. I do my research on my own, but it's part of a bigger project, and we all have our scope, and that's where like different epistemologies, different disciplinary backgrounds can really be additive. So my colleague Billy is an economic sociologist. He really has this market-based interest in this phenomenon, like making this analogy with conventional labor markets, like what's new here? Why should we study it? I'm an organizational sociologist. I am very interested in how digital technologies change the way we work. My dissertation was all about distributed work and boundaries, working with Natalia. And I realized how platforms are completely increasing skill rich organizations can utilize distributed work models to get work done. So there's a lot of opportunity there as well. Otto is a labor economist and data scientist. He built on a labor index. Some of you might have heard about it. And Alex is a labor sociologist. So we all have these different angles. Alex focusing on the worker side, me focusing on the platform and the client's organizational side. And then we have Otto and Vivi, kind of the overall picture. So now you can position like where I fit in. So why should we study work? We're talking about labor, we're talking about platforms, gig economy, we talked about markets, economies, but I think we should start with what is work and how is that changing with technologies. And work today is becoming increasingly distributed. We often work from home, it's a thing we do instead of always a location you go to. And organizations are opening up their boundaries in many, many ways, not all, only for knowledge reasons, also for talent reasons. Urbanization, making living in cities very, very expensive, and also employees and workers wanting to have more flexibility to take care of their elderly or their kids, etc., etc. And then the question is, when you start to work more remotely online, does it actually change like the rules of the game, how we do work? How labor markets operate, so does it change the institutions of work? That's basically the scope of my fieldwork. So we talked a bit about the institutions today, and even though I'm studying now, I still find this a very vague word, but basically it's like the standardized, like the how you internalized ways of doing things, the rules of the game, that's how I look at it. So what I'm going to talk about is... we already addressed it a bit, so I'm going to skip over like what are online labor platforms, why should we study them, my approach is doing ethnography, and kind of the opportunities and challenges there. The conventional relation and what we kind of see is that platforms start to mediate the relations between workers and clients, and I don't have to tell much about that. We talked about gig economy platforms, but what I want to emphasize here, this is one manifestation of how work is changing. It's part of a bigger phenomenon. And when we talk about Uber or Deliveroo, in many respects, I see them as extremes that get a lot of media attention, but there's much more going on in work. And we should focus on this range of phenomena happening and try to understand what is the pattern forward. What we focus on is online labor platforms, and we define them as the work. It's happening online, so where the client and the freelancer, the worker, are never in the same space. So we don't see Uber as an online labor platform because they meet in a physical setting. But for instance, freelancer.com or Upwork, those are kind of the marketplaces we talk about. And that can be gig work, that can be crowdsourcing, but it can also be online freelancing. Here I came kind of with my own type of categorization, and we already talked about it. Where I see crowdsourcing fitting in, it's like a task going to multiple workers, and multiple workers can work on the same task. I see micro work as one task going to one worker and another task going to another worker. It's usually pretty small, and you don't need a lot of specialized knowledge. When you go to the other extreme, it's like one task going to one worker, but it's highly specialized. So when work is highly specialized, increasing the scale of a platform does not necessarily increase the competition because not everybody has the same highly specialized expertise. And that's where I see there's a growth opportunity here for online freelancing to be a feasible model where you can have more flexibility in terms of how and when you work and not like bringing some of the negative impacts of what we previously talked about. So basically, I'm not sure if everybody knows the work process. I impose a job, the platform, it's not algorithmic management, it's algorithmic matching. The platform does the matching. The worker submits a proposal to a job that's being posted, and the client evaluates the proposals, conducts interviews. It's pretty much a standard hiring process. And then the platform helps to form the contract, so that's where the standardization comes in. Deliverables are submitted to the platform, so that's kind of a guarantee the platform gives. The client evaluates and releases the payment, and the platform offers support, not only payment protection, but also disputes and mediation. And in that sense, I think we can call it a labor market, in that sense. So why should we study them? Well, we're tracing the top five platforms on a daily basis, and on Wednesday, it was 125.7 as an index, and we started in, I think it was kind of April 2016, where we set the index on 100. So within a year, we kind of saw like 26% growth. When you compare it to the growth of a conventional labor market, that's quite big. It's quite extraordinary. Of course, like the scale of the jobs is way different. Last year, the amount of jobs that were created on the platform, I think, was equivalent to around 8,000 full-time positions. So it's still like a phenomenon that's very much growing, emerging, and changing on a day-to-day basis. But it, it is happening, and we need to get a better understanding of how this phenomenon is taking off and the directions. And when I said when I applied for the job, like, your proposal is pretty nice, but we should also study the clients that are using them. We should not only study the freelancer side. So why are organizations actually working with freelancers? We already have outsourcing. And so I studied the clients that are using it, and to my surprise, actually quite big companies are using it, like Samsung, Procter & Gamble, Microsoft. These are big players in this space, and really trying to understand, like, what are the narratives and discourses that inform their transition towards this type of work. And they really talk about, like, the scarcity of talents and talent not always being able to find it in the location where your company is located, but more broadly distributed. And also the opportunities it gives them, and that goes way beyond cost savings. So here are some of the types of work that are being done, like design, video production, content marketing is a big one, software IT development, data science is an important part. Just to get some understanding, like, what types of work are we talking about? And it's not all gigs. Like, these jobs can be a few hours, like fixing a PowerPoint, but it can also be like in a customer support, it can be like 2 years you're working for somebody. And that's where I feel like we have this broader narrative where we see, like, okay, companies are starting to experiment with work models where workers are more remote. Of course, that creates the challenge of how can you trust your workers if they're actually doing the work. And there the platform comes in as not only a matching model, a matching service, but also having the service of work diaries and coordinating and kind of looking if the worker is actually working. And where companies first started with very small gigs to experiment with this model, and actually now see that they are more towards the core, and that these are long-term engagements. So one of the top platforms, actually now 85% of the jobs they say is hourly work instead of a fixed price gig. So if online work is on the rise and firms are adopting it, we should set out and study the platform and actually develop these markets, like what goes into this design, what product and service offerings do they develop, and why? Can everything be solved by algorithms and AI, or do you always need to have some human services there? How do you decide on the features and design of the platform? And how do those comprise new institutions of work and of the marketplaces? And then what we see is, the difference is that now there are private actors in charge of creating and managing these marketplaces, whereas in a conventional labor market, it's usually the government. So very valid reasons to go into those organizations, make the effort, and really study what's going on. Who are these people there? And are they folk, Uber guys, or no? Because we usually make a lot of assumptions about the organizations that build those platforms. And we have to realize every actor and every stakeholder brings their own perspective. So in the past year, I've been mostly been away in the US collecting data, and now 12 months plus, I think it will be 15 months in total. And mostly participant observation I did at one of the top online labor platforms. Documents and analysis, doing lots of interviews. I think there are like 150 or something at the moment. Still have to do the counting and scraping online and conversational data. And to make this really practical, I'm just going to show you how I did it and some fragments of my data. And it's not really about the content. It gives you a glimpse of what data I have, but mostly about, like, how these companies and the digital technologies we have now can also, we can innovate our models of collecting data. So for instance, this is a fragment of doing observations. So in this company, every meeting can be attended remotely. It's never that all people are in the same office. Yeah. So usually I would join the meeting, like, in the office, but also join the meeting remotely. So here you see, I had to anonymize the pictures, but this is an engineering team, and they're talking about the engineering work and, like, making their plan for the next week. So those are all their tickets they're working on. So I could make screenshots of what they are working on. And here I use audio notes, which I think is a really useful tool for observations because it makes timestamps. So you make notes and it makes timestamps of your audio recording. And here I put 12:30, so I made a screenshot at 12:30. And I note the time of that screenshot where they're working on. So when I'm working out my field notes, I can insert all the pictures of the work documents and the technologies they're using. So this is just an example of like how you can do observations and the advantages of this online setting gives you in capturing how work is happening. And usually in when you think about an offline setting, sometimes this is really hard to see all the documents and people might not have the shared documents in front of them. So this is another one, online team collaboration. This was actually a brainstorm session where the team was evaluating how they worked, what went wrong, what went good. And actually these are all the team members around. And you see like they do like design thinking online. So these were all post-its and everybody was creating their post-its and then they would restructure it. I was making videos of how they did it online. So you kind of see like what everybody contributed, like the themes that emerged. And I think this is unique data that we start to collect in this setting. And collecting documents is way easier. People just share it through the cloud services. So one of my projects is to study like the development of the new matching algorithms of this platform. Part of it is already implemented in some of the categories. The entire design and what data goes into this process and the development of these algorithms. So yeah, one of the documents. Here I made a picture of myself because I didn't make a picture of interviewing somebody. But interviewing, you can go to the office, you research for the interview, but you never know if the person is really there because they can also work from home. Because there's no policy to show up in the office. You can work from anywhere. So remote interviewing in social science, we've been sometimes quite hesitant about doing it. But in today's, how should I say, like time, like we're way more comfortable, like who's Skyping with the parents? Like I do it almost every week. Like we have FaceTime on our computers. So yesterday I was Skyping with this customer support person, social media person in Toronto. Like this is happening and it makes it way easier to do really qualitative research. And I mean, I could have done the entire research without leaving my house, but I wanted to go and see the office, so I went. But it's just showing like there's a lot possible at the moment. And it's like conversational data. I joined all the communication channels of the teams I studied. And because they're remote, it's they're communicating through this channel. So you can follow the entire work process, like from ideas, problems, documents, like what here he called, he's talking about like how should we code things. So when you think about like studying how people design these platforms, there's a lot of data available when you get access. So let's see if I had another one. Web data is another one. The work outputs, like when it's materialized, you see it on the platform. This is actually the announcement of part of the new matching system is to create specialized profiles. It's sort of becoming more task-based, as we talked about before. And then there are different methodological challenges. So there are lots of opportunities to get great data. And I'll just put these questions here and then give the floor to the other ones and then we can have like a collective discussion. So one is gaining access, that's the number one. So I can talk about that. One is establishing relations with participants. Having access to a platform doesn't mean that people actually want to talk to you. That's a whole other story and there's a lot of relational work involved. And then how do you cope with legal or public relations? Because, like we said, the scientists are always very critical about this phenomenon, and especially the media has been quite critical of what's going on, and I think that's good. But it's also making assumptions about who these people are that design these platforms. And these assumptions are not always based on really talking to them and seeing the work that is happening, the ideas that go into it, but often how outsiders perceive what they do and then kind of black box it. And that makes them like hesitant to let people in, because maybe you're this spy who just wants to prove your preconceived notions. And I think, like, going back to the idea of theory building, grounded theory, we study the phenomenon. We have all these theories in mind, but we're going to see what's happening on the ground. What are the ideas that people, from which they start to work on building these platforms? How do they go about it? And are they all like these bad Uber engineers? Or are there other challenges? This is unpaved territory, what they're working on, experimenting every day. And I think there's a story worth telling there. And also, like, the way we try to incorporate, like, the technological challenge in theorizing to come to more nuanced and detailed understandings of what's happening in this part of reality. So I can also talk about, like, what implications there you can, or what insights. So I almost got kicked out of this company because of some work that my colleague published. And we were from the same department, so they were like, what are you actually doing? Yeah. And then how do you solve that situation? And actually, I ended up with legal coming to both my goodbye parties and actually inviting them out to come back. There's also a way to cope with it in a very positive way, and actually using your research to also answer some of the questions. Okay, I'll leave it at that.
As Greta, thank you. I would like to present some of my work and at the same time focus on the methodological approaches I used, of course, but I chose a tiny bit a different approach. So I chose to present some of my empirical work, to present some of the results. So you see actually the kind of work I've been doing, and then after doing that, reflect on some of the methodological challenges I've been facing. And I do not have a lot of time, but I wanted to present all of my work to you now. So, but I had to make a decision, so I decided to shortly present something on my qualitative and also my quantitative work. So we have like kind of different kind of methodological perspectives here today. And we talked about this earlier, about algorithmic management in the context of Uber, and this is actually some work that I do. And Sarah left, she had to leave after lunch, but maybe I can enrich discussion somehow. So I work at Warwick Business School, and this is Andy Lockett. So he's the dean of the business school. And I would argue that he's somehow my boss. If it's not my head of group, he's my boss. And now I would like you guys to picture your boss. And I'm not sure who that might be. In case you work at a business school, that might be the dean, or in case you have a supervisor, that might be your supervisor. Think about the discussions you have with your boss. Think about the decision your boss made that you needed to implement, right? Think about that. And now imagine your boss is actually an algorithm. Or do you think that would somehow affect your work satisfaction? Or would it lead to tensions? Or do you think it would in any way affect your work-related behavior? Might be, right? So some of you might now say, well, Mareike, that's really unlikely to happen, because it's very unlikely that the dean of a business school is replaced by an algorithm. But that's actually a reality for hundreds of thousands of Uber drivers. They are managed by an algorithm every day. And they're actually supervised and controlled by this mobile platform. And you probably all have used Uber, so you have seen those kind of mobile platforms next to the driver. And this platform is telling you whom to pick up, which route to take, and so on and so on. And actually in this study, we focus on Uber as a case. And it's can be located in a broader research interest on algorithmic management. And why is that such a fancy topic, I would argue, at the moment? Well, we all know that due to like increasing importance of big data and want more advanced machine learning techniques, algorithms these days, they can just very efficiently adapt to environments, right? So they can learn. So what we can see is that they do not only help managers in decision support, but they're actually taking over complex tasks that have previously conducted by middle or even upper management. But let me talk a bit more detail about the data we got in this context of our Uber study. So there are three data sources, right? First one's informed interviews, the second with Uber drivers, the second one is observations of Uber drivers, and the third one is we got data from this uberpeople.net blog. It's a grounded study. So we started being interested in the phenomena, but we didn't know what we wanted to focus on. So we started by informally talking to the Uber drivers, by browsing the forum and see what was going on there, and by observing them. And then we realized, well, there's some tensions there, in particularly the management practices of Uber and this autonomy of Uber drivers. There are some tensions, and so we got more interested in it, and we started getting more data in a more structured way, right? So we started conducting formal interviews. We started using keyword search to narrow down all these millions of posts that were available on the platform and to inform our research. And because I do not have a lot of time, I can't walk through the model in super much detail, but this is the final model we came up with. And let me shortly explain the major idea of our model. So we detected that Uber is using algorithmic management practices to manage their drivers, and we identified three features that we consider to be algorithmic management. The first one is that there's a constant tracking of driver's behavior, right? So this app, it is opened. There's, you know, like all this data is collected, like a huge volume of data collected, like every minute, about the location, about the performance of the driver, how long the driver needs to pick up a person, and so on. The second one, that there's constant performance evaluation. Why so? Because now you have so much data, it's very easy to benchmark performance of workers, right? And the third one is that there's an automatic implementation of decisions. This is why previous researchers have actually said something like, algorithms actually do things. Just one example. So in case like a driver's rating was getting below a certain threshold, they were just kicked off the platform, mm-hmm. right? Automatically, without further discussion. Well, and then we saw tensions because on the other hand, Uber drivers are freelancers. They are supposed to have like certain flexibility about work-related aspects, such as rent to work. They were using their own car, they're leasing their own car, they showed very low identification with Uber, but were identifying as an autonomous entity. So the major tensions we identified were actually also mentioned by Sarah earlier. The first one is that there's very low transparency, which means is that the underlying logic of these algorithms was just like, well, not understandable by the drivers. They didn't understand the underlying logic of the algorithms, and they actually had the feeling that they were not in line of what they signed up for when they decided to drive for Uber. So they were very unsatisfied about that. And the second tension was mainly that they're working in social isolation, that there was no human being they could interact with, so there was no human boss they could talk to. In case they were facing challenges or problems, they just had to send an email, that's it. So we identified four response mechanisms, behaviors of Uber drivers in response to these tensions. The first one we mainly identified in the forum, it was guessing the system. They started to exchanging views in the Uber forum, exchanging views and opinions about why the algorithm would come up with a certain decision and why not. Right? So for instance, there was a driver and driving to the airport was immediately matched to a customer, but another driver had to wait an hour to be matched to a customer. So Uber drivers got upset about it and were exchanging these views in the forum. We also saw that they were resisting the system. For instance, they were assigned to an Uber pool ride and they didn't like that, so they and just try to not take this over full ride. They were switching the system. This is something actually mainly observed in New York. They had different apps open at the same time, apps of competitors like Uber, Lyft, Juno, and Get. So they were actually strategically switching between competitors and driving for different ride-hailing companies. And then we also saw that they were gaming the system. They did all this to regain back control, work autonomy, and maximize self-benefit. I do not have a lot of time, so let me just dive into one aspect. This is the gaming the system aspect. We actually got quite a lot of media attention for it because apparently that seemed to be very interesting to people, that Uber drivers fight back against these algorithmic management practices of Uber. And we define all of the mechanism. This is just one example for them gaining the system. We define it as a mechanism by which freelance workers seek to identify and exploit loopholes in the system to their advantage. And this is just a quote from the Uber People New York Forum, and Uber drivers are actually exchanging views and talking about how they want to stay, they are staying locked off until search pricing kicks in, and how they're manipulating the system. Right? Just to give you a short example of the data. Well, and actually, so this is our work. Let's talk about methods. And this is actually one example. I said we had three data sources. So the Uber drivers are gaming the system. We only found evidence about this in the block data. Right? They wouldn't talk about it when we were like interviewing them. Well, probably because of the social desirability bias. But this was, for instance, very, very interesting for us. And if I just move back in the model, the Uber drivers were individually or even collectively trying to guess the system, we mainly found evidence in the block data too, because they used these blocks to get together and exchange views. The Uber drivers were switching. We mainly observed that. So this was mainly based, like a finding mainly based on observations, because we saw that they had different Uber apps open at the same time. So my point here is that it's like using these three data sources enabled us to come up, you know, just take different perspectives, and the different data sources helped us to really identify different aspects in the data. Okay, so there was one of my experiences, and now I would like you to present you some of my other work, which is more like quant work, so we kind of have a balance and also talk about some quant work here. I also conducted a lot of research on how to build trust in the so-called sharing or gig economy, mainly digital trust. And I'm involved in several projects. This is a project which was joined with Arun Sundarajan, also from NYU, and people from BlaBlaCar, including Fred Marcella, who is the CEO of BlaBlaCar. So I'm not sure if you're aware of what BlaBlaCar is. It's a city-to-city ride sharing system. So in case you have a spare seat in your car and you want to go from one city to another, for instance from Paris to Berlin, you just go on this platform, listen on the platform, and someone's joining you in your car, like a stranger is joining you in your car, and they just pay you a small amount of money to join you in the car. So this is data based on an N of about 18,000 respondents across 11 European countries. So we have a representative sample here for Europe. And just to show you something that we did here. So we found, for instance, when being interested in trust and asking questions about trust, how much do you trust your family, how much do you trust someone else using BlaBlaCar, we found that obviously, like most people, more than 90% highly trust their family and friends, right? We found that, what was then surprising is that we found that 88% of the respondents highly trusted a member with a full digital profile on BlaBlaCar. So we find that actually more people trusted a stranger with a full digital profile compared to their colleagues. So it's quite surprising. So what does this tell us? It tells us that digital trust cues can leverage trust in strangers, right? That once we have digital trust cues in place, referring to someone with a full digital profile, we trust strangers. So what do we mean with a full digital profile? So this is based on the REAMS framework, on what blah 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 considers as a full digital profile. So you as a user, or like a user declares personal information, they upload a picture, they have a name, they have a rating, you know, they might be verified, they're this means moderated, so there's moderation by the platform, they're verified by the platform. They might connect their profiles to social media profiles such as Facebook. They're active and engaged on the platform. Wow. So, yeah, so that was interesting. But then we thought, yeah, well, but on the other hand, it's kind of mingling two sorts of trust. It's mingling trust in this person, the peer you're sharing with, and trust in the platform and the brand. Right? So and then here we try to disentangle these trust dimensions. So because we have data about how much people trusted a member with a full digital profile and blah blah car, it was 88%. But when we asked them how much you trust a person with a full digital profile on a generic platform that is not blah blah car, we saw that only 67% of the respondents say they would have high trust. So we argue that this difference would be somehow the brand effect, right? People trust users with a full digital profile on BlaBlaCar more than someone on a generic platform. So then there's more data. I don't want to talk too much about, there's so much data, just a glimpse of what we've been doing. So we also compared. So we had a look at the sharing economy services users used before started using BlaBlaCar. Most they started after using BlaBlaCar, then we can, for instance, see that most users mainly have been using the buying and conducted certain sharing activities, which is the buying and selling of used goods, but were less engaged in others such as peer-to-peer car rentals. But in future, they're planning to be engaged in different sorts of sharing economy activities. So in the end, this is just very simple quant data, right? This is descriptive data. This is not even multivariate analysis. I also work on multivariate analysis projects, several, but this is just a project which is really nice to present in a short amount of time because it has all these flashy graphs and so on. We have all these flashy graphs in our reports. But what I wanted to say concerning this kind of like quant, getting quant data, these are results you can only come up with quant data, right? So you can say, oh, trust someone more, like whatever. This is 30% more, 30% more. So more people trust someone with a full profile on BlaBlaCar compared to their colleagues. You know, like these fine-grained differences. These are results you can only get with quant analysis. And with this data set, you can actually compare trust levels across different different countries. So this is also, these are results you can only get with quant data. Well, but there are also challenges to this. This is just survey data. So many people would say, well, survey data, well, there are certain challenges with survey data because it's kind of only capturing people's belief or intentions. You should do experiments. Okay, so that's what we do in a different context. And I don't want to go in too much detail on this one. This is an ISIS paper, which was actually presented last year. And now we're getting data and analyzing the data. And because I do not have so much time left, I just want to talk about advantages and disadvantages of this methodological approach. So this is actually a very complex laboratory experiment, but we're having different phases. So we're actually building a platform and people are engaging in this experimental design. So they are, we're just trying to copy the Airbnb business model. So someone would list what they're offering on the platform. Someone would search for a listing, then would request a listing, would pay a price, and so this is very much based on the game sharing game. So we call it sharing games, but this is like a very standard procedure in the trust, so-called trust games that you know from economics, right? So then you would increase the amount three times, and then you would test for trust and reciprocity by seeing how much money is actually transferred back and forth between the different parties. So, well, I mean, this method has a lot of advantages, mainly because you can measure repeated behavior, which is really nice because you can measure behavior instead of just intentions or beliefs. So, I mean, this is great, right? But there are also lots of disadvantages with this method because it's like so complex, it's so expensive to set up. And especially when you think about the so-called sharing economy, there are offline and online experiments. So having or building this experimental design, it takes a lot of time. It's an experiment that takes place over like several days. And that would be somehow the disadvantage with this method. So let me finish up. I'm not presenting results on this one. My recommendation is just like think broad in terms of methods. There's so much you can do. All the methods have advantages and disadvantages. Sometimes it makes sense to use several methods to look at one aspect. So you kind of build papers on each other.
I'm so happy to be here in business school. Thank you to Demetrius and Pedro for inviting me. I'm based here at Sussex, but I'm over in global studies. I'm in the Department of Anthropology, and not only is this my first time presenting in business school here, I think this might be my first time ever being in a business school, so bear with me. Today I'm going to talk about a project that I've been working on over the past year in fits and starts. And I've titled the presentation Studying the Sharing Economy, Methodological Approaches, because I thought that's what I had to call it. And I didn't read the instructions carefully enough. I didn't know gig economy was an option. And the reason why I say that is that I've never thought of my work in terms of the sharing economy. But I thought, I'll put it up there, and then over the course of the morning, I'll learn all about what this sharing economy is, and then I'll speak very fluently about it. And as an anthropologist, you know, when we think about sharing, we think about reciprocity with the possibility of equalization. And so I thought, this is certainly not sharing going on here. But anyway, I'll be interested to talk about it more as we go along. Entering into these issues from the perspective of labor, from workers, and from experiences of trade unions, a lot of what I'm going to talk about, to me, look very conventional sort of employment relations, using the term employment very loosely, in terms of attempting to sort of offload risk onto workers and pay them as little as possible, while still wanting them to do a good job, so having a certain amount of control without too much reciprocal obligation. I just wanted to thank the speakers this morning for kind of opening up some of these questions around categories and concepts and terms, and I think Ariana said some really interesting things about, you know, what terms are we using to define gig economy, sharing economy. I'm actually going to try and speed through this a bit. I think there's a lot we want to talk about, so I'm going to choose to go a bit quickly, but if you have anything you want me to expand upon, I'm really happy to. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about this study I've been doing that I'm very much in the midst of, and I've engaged very opportunistically, as you'll see. It's something that's kind of come up in my midst, and I've seized it as a research study. And I'll try to be coherent and make sense, but I don't want to present this research as being more kind of logical or linear in its progression than it has actually been. It's been quite a messy project, and I'll keep some of that mess in here. So the study I've been working on is about riders, bicycle riders, scooter riders who work as couriers for the Deliveroo, for food delivery company that we've heard a lot about already. So I won't give you too much background on that. It was founded in London in 2013 by Will Hsu, and its tagline, or one of its many taglines, is "Your favorite restaurants delivered fast to your door." It's now in approximately 150 cities around the world, and really the quintessential Deliveroo rider, or at least the one who's advertised They can be on scooters or bikes, but really they're the kind of face of the company, the brand's visibility out on the roads. And there's as many as 10,000 riders working in London. Is a number that's disputed. Different orders, I'm happy to talk about that if you'd like, but there's far fewer than that who regularly deliver food. And how it works, we've heard a bit about, is through an app that has two versions. There's the customer-facing version, where you can order food, and the version that is the rider-facing version, where they log on and indicate their availability to collect food from a restaurant and deliver it, and it tracks the progress and all that algorithmic management. So I'm really just breezing through now. And so in Brighton and London, where I've been doing this research, riders are paid a fee per drop. Every time they do a delivery, they get a certain amount of money. It's different in both places, but riders elsewhere in the country work on different models. But in thinking about your algorithm being your boss, and like thinking a lot of these companies like to present themselves fundamentally as tech companies, I was really struck by something that a rider said to me only about a week and a half ago. He said, "This business is the direct conversion of muscle power into profit. It could not be more obvious than someone on a bicycle. You're using your muscles to make a delivery. You are literally converting the power of your muscles, pushing the pedals of a bike into the profit of the company when you make that delivery." I'm so trying to resist the urge to elaborate too much and make my talk about this. So just don't agree with me. I'm just gonna keep going. So we'll keep that in the back of our mind because I'll be talking about the methods. I'll just briefly mention how I became involved in this project. The research journey, I thought it might be important to just kind of contextualize it within my other research because it sort of frames the questions I've been asking and my orientation towards the research, particularly around these methodological issues. So I've actually spent the past 15 years working on the global garment industry, beginning in the 2000s with research on the garment industry in the Caribbean and how it's sort of declined under the competitive pressures of neoliberal globalization, and more recently looking at the governance of health and safety in Bangladesh's garment industry. And why this is significant to me and to my purposes today is that I really come from a background in the anthropology of work and seeing labor regimes from the point of view of workers by embedding myself as an anthropologist within a site for a long period of time, watching and talking and asking questions. And this type of long-term immersive field research, generates sort of rich and contextualized accounts of workers' experiences. And I would argue produces knowledge that's not available through other means. But what I want to highlight for our purposes today is that it generates research that's necessarily empathic, people-centered, and very often, especially when it comes to precarious workers, low-wage workers, very often quite political in terms of the kinds of solidarities and commitments you develop with workers who you spend many months or years with, as you establish long-term trust and spend time working alongside them. Which brings me to Deliveroo, which is such a fascinating case study. I mean, we've mentioned it a few times today already, bringing together new technologies of work, new ways of companies engaging with workers who deliver their services, and then more broadly, bringing in the legal context of employment and labor law. And then finally, these issues around labor rights organizing, around protest and trade union activity in response to this. And this is an image of a protest that took place here in Brighton earlier this year. I also had some other photos. I don't know why I took them out, because everyone likes more photos, but of protests in London, especially in August 2016. There's quite an uproar over changes to payment, means of payment. And so for me, I've been looking for some time for a project that I could really embed myself in and do participant observation and ethnographic field research. And I thought this was an intriguing case, particularly when it comes to this question around trade unions and the dilemma that companies like Deliveroo sort of
apparently opposed for long-standing ways of workers organizing, kind of making us wonder, you know, are trade unions fit for purpose in the gig economy? What new forms of labor resistance and organizing are taking place? And I would argue that these challenges are mirrored very much in the challenges of doing ethnographic research. You know, where are these people? Are they gathering in one place? Are they dispersed? Are they quite independent? Do they want to talk to you? You know, that actually comparing the experiences of labor organizers and the inquiring ethnographer actually have a lot of resonance between the two. So how I came, there were two initial seeds that got me involved in the research project on Deliveroo. The first was actually for my students. I'm sure, like many of you, many of my students work as Deliveroo riders. And I had one in particular who was very involved in the trade union movement here in Brighton. And because I teach a module on precariousness and the global economy, you know, the students were just talking about this. A lot of what we were learning in the classroom resonated with their own experiences. And this is just a copy of a blog post I wrote for the blog that we run with the master's students in anthropology. And so, you know, a group of us, a group of undergrads, went to a march, just out of curiosity, the May Day march here in Brighton. And, you know, just to find out what was going on. So we just became involved through students and the sort of activism they were involved with. And then the other seed was from my interest in the IWGB. And I don't have time to say much about them. Happy to, if you have questions. But there's this great book by edited by Sean Lazar in Cambridge. And I was in Cambridge earlier this year, presenting some of my Bangladesh work on trade unions, and at that conference, representatives from IWGB also attended, and that's where I met them. And they were presenting on their successes organizing porters in the University of London, and couriers like City Sprint and Excel, and Deliveroo and Uber, and just talking a lot about their experiences. And I still have these fundamental questions. Well, how does trade unionism even work within these circumstances? I'm much more familiar with the factory context, where, you know, it's just such a kind of classic case of labor all in one place, etc. And so it just piqued my interest very much, and I began to work on the kinds of questions that I would investigate. So thinking about how are labor rights conceptualized in the gig economy? What are the particular challenges that app-based work, the on-demand work, just-in-time labor, etc., in the gig economy pose to labor organizing and trade unionism? How are workers and labor rights organizations responding to precarious work of various kinds? Is the emergence of on-demand app-based work reconfiguring labor rights in law and in practice? So these were some of the questions I was beginning with earlier this year and writing up in a research proposal with methods that would fall along similar lines to the work I've done in the garment industry. So thinking in the first instance about participant observation as hanging out, chatting, watching and participating with riders going about their work and leisure. So yes, in the workplace, you know, as discourses that might be, but also in off time to chatting, getting to know people. Secondly, semi-structured interviewing, which is sort of the heart of this study, which is gathering stories, employment histories, experiences. And this is the type of interviewing that would take place, you know, at multiple points, returning back to the same individuals, particularly as things happen in the media, new, you know, rulings come out from various court cases, things, exposés come out in the media, and kind of using that broader context as something to bring back, or experiences around personal observation as something to bring back into interviewing, and then observation also being a component of that. So as I was planning this research, in May 2017, an opportunity came up, which was the Central Arbitration Committee hearings in relation to a group of Deliveroo riders in London's Camden area who had petitioned for recognition of the IWGB as their trade union. And I thought, well, actually, I can spend the next 6 months putting together a research proposal, waiting to see if it gets funded, you know, doing the whole kind of long arc of putting together research, or I can just put together a project very quickly and start looking at what's happening on the ground. And so this is when I turn to the lessons learned from this kind of research. I think I found it very useful to be responsive to things that are happening and to be opportunistic. And so I attended the committee hearings and have used this particular case as a lens onto the experiences of delivery riders, of the trade union, within this very specific context of UK law around collective bargaining and union recognition. And what that case had to decide was whether the IWGB had sufficient support among delivery riders in the Camden area to represent them for collective bargaining purposes. And again, this raises all sorts of questions. Well, what is the group? What is the unit for collective bargaining purposes? Isn't this just some big pool of labor that logs on and logs off at will? What does this even look like as a unit? And then the second question, which actually in a way turns out to be the first one, which is actually, are delivery riders workers in the first place in the eyes of the law? Certainly from the perspective of Deliveroo, they said, no, these are suppliers. These are self-employed suppliers. They're not workers. They're certainly not employees, but they're not even workers. And in fact, as the case was decided, the CAC said, yes, they do have sufficient support, but it doesn't matter because delivery riders aren't workers. I'm happy to talk about that more if you are interested. And so the idea is to use this kind of small story as a way of opening up into these broader issues. And I've been sitting down and doing these semi-structured interviews with participants in this case and getting their different points of view. It's ongoing because it's being appealed, etc. And so really just to sum up, so I think, you know, for me, some of the lessons and challenges and takeaways is really that in this type of research, working with the trade union, working with riders who are engaging in protests of various kinds, that there really isn't a kind of neutral space to occupy. There's a requirement of a certain kind of commitment and solidarity. And that's not to say there shouldn't be politically neutral research. It's just that the kinds of questions I'm exploring and the kinds of research methods that I'm using and the way in which they come together and, you know, establish trust and, you know, kind of long-term relations with writers. This is, there's certain obligations on me as well to accompany and engage in some of these different activities. The importance of timing, as I mentioned earlier, going over the story with, and this puts constraints on us, particularly around the need for funding cycles, etc. So I'm still writing a project proposal for the second half of the research, although I'm just starting the first half of it. Thirdly, ethnography, you know, really thinking about ethnography not just as collecting data that can take away and analyze, but actually thinking about ethnography as engaging in these different sites to generate ideas about what's happening. So being in the hearings for the CAC, you know, having it sort of kind of spark ideas about, well, what are the dynamics going on here? What are the power relations? What are different sorts of claims being made? And using that, again, to take back to individual informants to probe a bit deeper. And then finally, to I would say my fourth takeaway is the importance or usefulness of taking academic production outside or beyond scholarly journals. And so our Culture and Capitalism blog that we run in the Anthropology Department has been tremendously useful in terms of producing kind of shorter pieces of work and then sharing them back with writers who have spent time with me. And that can be useful as well because, you know, people are giving up their time, especially if you're working in the gig economy and you could have done two or three or four deliveries in the amount of time that you spent chatting to me. Seeing, you know, not saying, oh yeah, this is going to come out in this really great four-star article 4 years from now, but actually saying, look, there's what you're spending time with me and telling me things that are going on. Some of this I'm going to share now and you can share it through your networks and so on. And so kind of having that more be a space for conversation.
And that's all for special episode 40. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed these conversations. And granted, the quality may have been going in and out here and there, but these are recordings of panels. So we will be holding more events in the future, and we do encourage our listeners to come and participate. It's always a pleasure to meet you and to get some feedback from you, learn what you think of the podcast, and how it's helping you in your life and practice. Next time, we are wrapping up season 4 with an amazing episode on an iconic book, Images of Organizations by Gareth Morgan, here on Talking About Organizations.